Easter is over. Some of us travelled, visited family and friends, and some of us, like me, stayed home and ate far too much chocolate. And life has, well, pretty much returned to how it was. Wars are still being fought. Our earth and oceans and skies are still being overused and polluted. The most vulnerable in our communities are excluded and at risk. And even within us, our bodies still bear injury and disease. Our relationships are strained. Our minds weary with the concern of it all. What difference, if anything, did Easter make? This is the question that two disciples ask on the road to Emmaus. Luke sets the account on the same day that several women had gone to Jesus' tomb and found it empty. A few verses earlier, the women were told by two terrifying men in dazzling clothes that Jesus had risen, and they had rushed back to tell the 11 disciples, who remained, we're told, unconvinced. Immediately, Luke shifts the scene. "And behold," he starts in the Greek, "suddenly we're with two other disciples, not of the 11, who have witnessed the events of Jesus' death and heard firsthand from the women at the tomb." Indeed, while one of the disciples is named as Cleopas, some commentary suggests that it's plausible his unnamed companion was his wife and one of the very same women who was at the tomb that morning. At any rate, the pair had certainly been close to the action. And yet, on the very day the women had found the tomb empty, here are two of Jesus' disciples doing what? Without even waiting out the day in Jerusalem to see what happens next, they've set off, presumably toward home, their feet dragging, their hopes for the great liberating Messiah dashed. Much like the disciples in John's account, who go back to their fishing boats after Jesus' death, they are returning to what they know. What's the point in hanging around a dangerous place like Jerusalem, where you might be associated with Jesus, when the story is already over? And the space that was opened at early dawn, as the women found the empty tomb, has closed down even before the sunset. You can hear the reluctance in their voices as the stranger draws beside them and asks what they're talking about. They stood still, looking sad. You can imagine them studying their dusty sandals, hoping the other one would talk first. This was not just any news they were asked to share. Their reluctance seems to me to be the shame of disappointed hope. I've often been struck in this story by the fact that their eyes were kept from recognising that it was Jesus himself who talked with them. I have to admit, I allow myself a measure of smugness at this point. You'd think the disciples would have recognised someone they'd been following. Who told them he'd be raised on the third day, and who wasn't in the tomb that morning. But this is exactly where Cleopas and his companion were at. They were not on that road, able to see Jesus through the cloud of their own expectations about the Messiah who was supposed to save Israel from the Roman occupation. They heard of the empty tomb, but they failed entirely to get the point. All along, they wanted Jesus to participate in their story, their human preoccupations. But what was about to happen was going to invert all that. As Jesus speaks to the disciples, he reorients for them the Messiah's suffering as the glory of his self-giving love and draws the whole story of Scripture around himself. We're told the disciples feel their hearts burn within them. they still haven't grasped that the story is all about the man beside them, but they feel the centre of gravity shifting so that the story begins to revolve around Jesus rather than themselves. By the time they reach Emmaus, though they still don't recognise Jesus, they urge the stranger to stay. This is the turning point, but it's easy to miss. This is the point at which they begin at last to participate in Jesus' story. Now, as Jesus breaks the bread, they are made able to see who he really is. And although he immediately vanishes, the disciples have entered the inside of Christ's story through a threefold opening: opening the scripture, opening their eyes, and opening their understanding. The disciples are able to enter at last into that space that opened with the tomb that morning. And their experience is transformed. That same hour, they got up and returned to Jerusalem. 7 long miles back, remember, and in the dark now, with no fear or hesitation, and seemingly all the energy in the world to find the 11 apostles and share with them what had happened. It's easy to appreciate why this is such a well-loved story. It taps into our deep desires to move out of disappointment and confusion and into joy, clarity, and hope. But if we try to jump too quickly to the end of the story, we may miss the nuances of what's really going on. And that's why I love this poem, The Road to Emmaus, by Christopher Mann, because it offers a way to slow down the narrative and hear it afresh. It's not the friendliest of villages, Emmaus, the people, parochial as desert people are, bound up in the herding and bartering of beasts, the vines on its terraces encumbered with thorns, the children in the market roasting a sparrow. Hardly the place to expect revelation, if revelation's the word. I leave that to you. Not that we'd never believed, my partner and I, not that, but leaving Jerusalem on business with news of the death, or perhaps I should say the absence among us, of someone like God, we felt at a loss and not a little diminished. And talk as we might of covenants and creeds, our thoughts came round to the price of wool and the bundles of raisins and dates in our pennies. Besides, by then we were tired of religion, what with the heat, the dust, a mule going lame, and the stranger who'd fallen in with our journey, going on about prophets, the life in that death, a vision which didn't make much sense at the time but stirred our hearts greatly before we tired, and hungry, irritable, slapping at the flies, entered Emmaus and tethered our beasts. But it should, that it could have been otherwise, presumes, I think, too much of human piety and grants few gaps for love's eruption, unbidden, uncalculated, into our lives. His hands, the strong sunburned fingers, breaking the rough brown bread of the tavern and writing a cross in the spaces between us, above the wine in the cracked clay goblets, the dim yellow sputter of the wick in its oil. His hands first brought it home to us in Emmaus. There was a silence, a humming, a burning, the coming more alive of all things about us. Those arms opened, their palms in shadow, embodying a promise, a blessing still live. And then, the sting of it still affects. A breeze off the desert entered that moment. The lamplight flared, a door banged shut. Emmaus, as I say, we never really go there. Emmaus comes to us when least expected. It's not just the journey, the settings out, the routes through the desert, the arrivals. It's travelling in readiness for a maze that counts. This poem's imaginative retelling puts us on the ground and prompts us to consider how we ourselves walk our own road to a maze. Disappointed, sick of waiting for things to turn around, wary of trusting, concerned with the price of dates in our panniers, not seeing Jesus through the cloud of our own preoccupations and expectations. This account invites us to recognise how even in our walking away, our strategic distancing, the utter beautiful grace of Jesus comes to us, falls in step with our pace on the road, and begins to engage us with truth. Emmaus comes to us when least expected. It's travelling in readiness for Emmaus that counts, writes Nan. The Christ-centred life calls us to our full participation, to move as the disciples did, from witness to witness, to more fully give ourselves to God's promise and call. And it seems a way to begin might be to hold open the space for God to meet us on our road by allowing, as Mann so beautifully put it, those gaps for love's eruption, unbidden, uncalculated in our lives. It might seem paradoxical to try and hold ourselves in readiness to encounter Christ when the initiative for that meeting is God's, is always God's. But if we are willing to let go of seeing ourselves as the main actors in the story, to hand over our self-preoccupations and enter Jesus' story, we can relax into being the receivers and allow God to be God. And from that stance, our readiness looks different as we live with all that Easter didn't change. Readiness now can mean our willingness to participate with Jesus in the life of his world, to offer hospitality, healing, and hope into its brokenness, to be willing to risk and to trust, to let go of our old stories when the new breaks in. We may even find ourselves willing, like Cleopas and his companion, to be turned around and walk in an entirely unexpected direction.